to the pension plan, need to get to understand a little bit more about the different types of pension plans. And we'll give you a very high-level overview of that. We'll look at some of the issues and challenges facing pension plans, including the McGill University pension plan. We'll talk about the changes that are taking place under the McGill plan, and we'll also look at what other pension plans are doing. So the discussion that we're going to be having today refers to the McGill University pension plan and the McGill University pension plan alone. It does not cover the other pension plans that are offered to other groups. When we look at pension plan types, there's two different types of pension plans. We have what's referred to as a defined benefit as well as defined contribution pension plans. So I'll give you a little bit of background information on both of those types. We'll start off with the defined benefit pension plan. Within defined benefit pension plans, these pensions are based on formulas. So you'll have a formula that will typically look at the years of service that you have with an organization. It'll also look at the earnings level that you have with that organization. And based on the formula, there will be a pension value that will be established for you. Now, in these type of pensions, if you know how long you're going to be working for that employer, you know what your salary is going to be roughly, you can estimate with relative accuracy what the value of your pension is going to be at the end of your career. The funding of these type of pension plans, it's based on valuations of the pension plan. So typically, every 3 years, most pension plans are required by law to go in and perform a valuation. And based on the results of those valuations, that determines how much money needs to be going into the pension plan. There's a concept of assets in the pension plan. There's a concept of liabilities in the pension plan. Whenever your assets, meaning the values, the stocks, bonds, money market instruments, and so on, is less than what the obligations are, then you are in a deficit position. A deficit position is very important in these type of pension plans because deficits determine the amount of funding that needs to be required. We often see these defined benefit pension plans with governments or with large organizations or large parapublic organizations, but we don't typically see defined benefit pension plans with small to mid-size organizations. The second type of pension plan that we often come across is a defined contribution pension plan. Here, we often refer to these type of pension plans as capital accumulation plans. Capital accumulations mean you put money aside. Depending on how much money you put aside, depending on the rate of return that you will have generated on those investments, that determines the value that you have available to you when you're ready to retire. So unlike the defined benefit plan, in a defined contribution, it's fairly difficult to guess, you know, at the end of a 30-year career or a 35-year career, how much your pension is going to be, because there's going to be a lot of variability depending on what the performance has been of the underlying investments. In these type of pension plans, the assets always equal liabilities. So there isn't this concept of a deficit or a surplus. It would be interesting if any of you do follow the markets. You know, 10, 15 years ago, there was often debates as to when there is a surplus in a pension plan, who does this surplus belong to? Well, those debates, we don't hear them any longer because it's rare today that you'll have a pension plan in a surplus position. Most pension plans of a defined benefit nature have a deficit. So the arguments of the past are no longer relevant today. They might become relevant down the road if we ever return to an environment where, you know, assets start becoming worth more than liabilities. But generally, we have a different environment right now. In defined contribution, the important part to keep in mind is that there never is a surplus, there never is a deficit. Assets always equal to your liabilities. And I'll be getting into a little bit more detail about what do we mean by, you know, what is a deficit under a pension plan. The legislation under defined contribution pension plans, you're capped as to the amount that you're allowed to put into the plan, but you're not capped as to how much you can pull out of the pension plan. So in good years, when the markets really perform strongly, you can get a really hefty rate of return, and everything is within the government regulations. Under a defined benefit pension plan, there's always a maximum withdrawal limit that you're capped by. Here at McGill, for those of you that are participating in the hybrid arrangement, that means that you're not participating in the pension plan for service employees union employees or members of the service employees union, and you are not participating in the simplified pension plan. This is the main pension plan of McGill. It is a hybrid arrangement, so it has elements of both a defined benefit as well as a defined contribution. Now, hybrid pension plans, in general, are not very common, and they can differ significantly from one employer to another employer. Here at McGill, we have an arrangement which is somewhat unique to McGill University. You'll be hard-pressed to find another organization offering exactly the same pension plan as what's being offered under the McGill University pension plan. When we look at the issues and challenges, when we have to also keep in mind what are the goals in the design of a pension plan. First and foremost, pension plans are a way to assist members to save towards their retirement. It doesn't mean that a pension plan is the only source of retirement income or the only planning that a member has to do. It's one of many different elements. And when we look at the different elements, we can look at, you know, registered retirement savings plans, tax-free savings account, non-registered investments that people can make on their own behalf. You have pension plans. You also have the Quebec pension plan and so on. So all of these different vehicles are ways for us to save towards attaining a retirement goal that we've set for ourselves. Pension plans also are a way to attract faculty and staff. But you also need to have a sustainable pension plan design. It means a pension plan doesn't have to be sustainable only during periods when market rate of returns are strong. They have to be sustainable throughout various type of periods and economies. You also want to be able to make sure that in the design of a pension plan that the contributions that are being made, those of the members, those of the plan sponsor, that you're making good use and efficient use of those contributions going through. So all of these elements get combined to help design a pension plan. When we look at the composition of a pension plan, if you look at a pension plan as being, can use the analogy of a bucket. And within that bucket, we have both assets as well as liabilities. And I'll be using that analogy throughout the remainder of the presentation to better explain a little bit of what the challenges are that are facing pension plans in general today. When we look at the asset side of a pension plan, this is where you're holding the actual physical assets. So we all make contributions to a pension plan. The plan sponsor makes contributions. Those contributions are invested in different assets. So what makes assets go up or the would be contributions being made? Whenever you get a good rate of return, that also increases the value of your assets. On the negative side, what you see the arrow in red pointing downwards would be sources that would cause the value of the assets to go down, which would be investment losses. We have years like 2008 that come along every once in a while where the actual value of your pension holdings can go down. You also have administrative costs that serve to decrease the value of the pension plan. On the opposite side of the fence would be liabilities or the obligations to make payments eventually to members. There, whenever interest rates go up, liabilities go down, and the reverse is true. Whenever interest rates go down, liabilities go up. And the reason for that is simple. It's a question of saying if you have a liability and interest rates are at 10%, you need a certain amount of money at a 10% rate of return to generate the rate of return that's required. If suddenly interest rates drop by half, and I'll use exaggerated examples just to illustrate the point, interest rates drop to about 5%, well, you'll need a lot more money invested at a lower rate of return to pay off those obligations. So it reasons that whenever interest rates go down, your pension obligations go up, and that's irrespective of what's going on as far as the assets are concerned. In defined benefit type pension plans, whenever we see people living longer, that means there's an obligation to pay for a longer time period. That causes liabilities to go up. So what's a good thing for all of us that we're all living longer from a pension plan obligation point of view, not so good. It means there's a longer debt payment schedule. We also have governments. I mentioned that in the defined contribution plans, the government limits the amount that we can contribute into the plan. Under defined benefit arrangements, the governments limit the amount that can be paid out. But these limits have been increasing. So whenever you start looking at amounts increasing all the time, well, that means that the liabilities, the obligations, are also increasing alongside with those. What causes liabilities to go down would be decreasing interest, or I mean increasing interest rates, the reverse. So we often see that happening where interest rates do go up regardless of what's happening on the asset side. It does mean our liabilities do go down ever so slightly. There's two different types of tests that are performed to determine whether a pension plan is in a solvent position. There's what's called a solvency valuation, and then there's a different type of valuation, which is going concern. We'll start off with a solvency valuation. Now, here what's important, just as the illustration shows, in a solvency valuation, you take away all of the inflows, you take away all of the outflows, so you take a picture in time. You pretend that you're never going to put another dime into the pension plan, you're never going to make another payout, and you say, what are the assets, what are the liabilities at that specific point in time? Under this type of a scenario, it's less relevant for a university because unlike the private sector where a company can go bankrupt, a university tends to be around for a long, long time. So we're less concerned about what happens or different snapshots at specific points in time from one day to the next. We look long term because we are a university. We're here for the long haul. But these are still one of the tests that are required under pension legislation. The second test, which is more relevant in our context, is to look at the going concern, which would mean we're not going to close our doors. We're going to continue to have members participating. Members are going to continue to make contributions. The university is going to continue to make contributions. And then look at to say, well, what does the future look like? What are the flows going in and out of the pension plan, assuming this continuity? And you perform that type of a test. When we look at, in general, what are the instances that we've experienced over the last little while? We go back in the terms of assets. When we look at years like 2008, and if any of you have invested in, you know, the balanced account, or if you have other investments within your registered retirement savings plans, you may be holding stocks during that time period, you'll know that 2008 was not a kind year. It really was harsh on the equity markets. So if you were holding stocks, the majority of the markets all declined and declined by a substantial amount. We have question marks. What's happening in 2011? And it seems to change from one month to the next. We've seen that at the beginning of the year, rates of return were good. We started going through a period of decreasing markets. Now towards the end, again, very much volatile markets. So one month, markets go up by a few percentage points. The next month, markets go down. We're pretty much in a flat position right now, or slightly negative, but nowhere near to the tune of 2008. But that still has very relevant significance for a pension plan. We've seen that over the last 10 years, the rates of return have been much more volatile than they were, let's say, over the last 40 years. We go back in time under the McGill University pension plan if you were invested in the balance account, and the balance account is one of the five available investment options. The rate of return was about an 11.5% cumulative rate of return prior to the last 10 years. Over the last 10 years, that rate of return has dropped down to closer to a 5% rate of return. So we've seen the markets behaving very differently over the last 10 years than they would have been behaving over the last 40 years. We've also seen interest rates declining substantially. So it's a good thing if you're looking for a mortgage and you've got to pay these mortgage payments when interest rates are down, you can say you benefit by having this lower mortgage payment. Now, if you're investing monies and you're part of a pension plan, not so good of a thing. We've seen the contribution limits being increased by the income tax regulators or Revenue Canada. We've also seen the maximum payouts that are allowed under the defined benefit arrangements being increased. And we know that with every generation, life expectancy continues to increase. So we can just go back in time a couple of decades ago. Normal life expectancy would have been 4 or 5 years less than what it is today. So as a population in Canada, we are living longer. So that does increase our liability. So all of these factors go into play when you're looking at a pension plan. The next chart is intended to say, well, how do we quantify some of the numbers that are that pertain to the various tests that I spoke about earlier? We have two different tests. We spoke about the solvency, which is the line indicated in blue. So under a solvency, if you recall, this is a one-shot deal. It's a specific point in time, and it tells you if you were to stop the plan, what is your assets, what are your liabilities, are you in a deficit or in a surplus position. And you'll notice over time, going back to 1998, which is over recent history when we had performed these tests, when we look at the valuation on a solvency basis, there was actually a surplus position of $11,000. Not a big one, but there was actually a surplus position. We can see that over time, we've been running into deficits, close to $7 million in the year 2000, going to a little over $11 million in 2006. Now we see the last cycle between 2006 and 2009, a significant change has happened, where the deficit went from $11 million to all the way up to $114 million. So it's not that deficits have doubled or tripled, they've gone up tenfold. That's significant, and it has significant implications for a pension plan. On a going concern basis, this is the one where he said it's a bit more relevant for universities because we know we're here for the long haul. We can see that what used to be surplus positions back in the late 90s are now significant deficits. And even significant surpluses as recent as December 2006 now represents liability streams of over $46 million. Now, these trends are not something that you can say will reverse themselves significantly over a short time period. They are long-term trends. When we look at to say what percentage of the assets is available to the members of the pension plan, when we look at the overall solvency ratio back in 2006, at the end of 2006 when the tests were performed, it meant that for every dollar of liability that existed, there was 99.2% or 99.2 cents on the dollar available in the pension plan to offset those liabilities. Now, this was a fairly enviable position because it meant that the pension plan was near fully solvent. You might have read in the papers recently where you had other pension plans, you know, that those numbers, they were nowhere even close to that. So the McGill plan was fairly solid at that point. Continues to be fairly solid at December 31st, 2009, just a little bit of a decrease from what it used to be. So overall, if we look at the pension plan as a whole, that position dropped to 91.5%. But there is a different test that's applied, which is called the degree of solvency. And the reason why that number is relevant, because it looks at, under the McGill plan, we have two different components. We have that defined contribution, and we have that defined benefit. So I mentioned earlier that under the defined contribution, the pension plan is always solvent. It always has the assets always equal the liabilities. So we put that portion of the pension plan aside, and we say for those members where they are participating in the defined benefit, and the defined benefit is yielding a higher value than the defined contribution, say for that portion of the pension plan alone, what is the position? And we can see there's been a significant deterioration in 2006, or at the end of 2006, that position was 97%. That means for anybody who had a defined benefit minimum, there was still 97 cents on the dollar in terms of assets versus the liabilities. We see that in December 2009, that number drops to 84%. The reason why the 84% is important, it means that whenever a person is leaving and they want to settle their pension plan holdings, that means withdraw the money from the pension plan only has 84 cents at that point in time to provide to the member. So the law says if you want to pay this person 100% of the obligations, more money has to go into the pension plan to be able to pay that 100%. Otherwise, the pension plan is legally obligated to pay only 84%. And they have 5 years in order to make up the difference, the shortfall, back to that departing member. Now, the university has looked at this situation because we do have many individuals who are in a defined benefit minimum position. And the position of the university is to say, no, we don't want to force these people to wait a full 5 years to get the value of their accounts. So they've been injecting more money into the pension plan to be able to permit individuals to be able to leave with the full value of their account holdings. When we look at what the impact has been on the overall operating budget of the university, we have to look at all of these measures combined. And what I've summarized on the table that you see in front of you is a little bit of what the obligations with respect to the university has been relative to all these changes that have been going on in the markets and following the results of those valuations. We could see that in terms of member contributions, just under the normal course of business, without any other changes taking place, the university has to be putting in more and more money because we have an aging population. Under the McGill University pension plan, the older we get, the more money the university contributes to the pension plan. So the fact that we have more and more people getting older and are participating still in the plan means that the contributions have been going up. But what never used to happen is under this defined benefit minimum provisions of the pension plan, there was never a requirement to infuse a lot of money into the pension plan. So for the last, from when the pension plan was first brought into existence back in 1972 to just recently, the amount that had to be contributed for this defined benefit minimum provision has been negligible. We can see those numbers in definitive dollars. Up until 2009, the amounts were non-existent or virtually non-existent. In 2009, the amount came out to be about $186,000. 2010, that number increases to $2.4 million. When we project that number forward going to January 2012, that number per annum skyrockets to $6 million. So the government has introduced some temporary relief measures to keep those numbers lower for the years 2010 and 2011, but in 2011, the full brunt of it comes into play. The amount of money that had to be kicked in to be able to keep people whole when they leave, again, used to be very negligible. 2010, an additional $1.3 million had to be infused into the pension plan in order to keep the person whole. So we can see that the landscape has changed significantly from what it used to be in the past. All this extra money that needs to be put in is non-sustainable from the university's perspective, where this has a direct impact on the operating budgets. At a time period where funding is becoming more and more tight, the requirements under the pension plan are requiring tens of millions of dollars to be put in that there isn't available to be put in. So when we look at these challenges, what are the choices available? And there aren't a ton of choices. You can either increase contributions or you can decrease benefits or do a combination of both. There are no other alternatives. And we can take a look at what's being put forward. In other pension plans, when we look at whether they be other universities or other plan sponsors in the private sector, you may be, if you follow anything that's going on in the pension plan universe through the papers, or if you're reading or if you're watching the news at times, what used to be non-events, you would rarely see pension plans getting news coverage. Today, it's almost every month. You see story after story about one pension plan or another making the news. And the reason why is that changes are taking place. We've seen virtually most pension plans, or all, have increased member or the plan sponsor contributions. We've also seen many pension plans reducing the defined benefit formulas. More generous formulas have had to be pulled back a little bit. Other provisions, such as early retirement subsidies, many employers now are starting to cut back on these very generous provisions. For those pension plans that actually provide the direct pension, like defined benefit arrangements, the indexation of pensions is starting to come under scrutiny. And there we're seeing changes where for future earnings, pensions aren't being indexed, or the amount of indexation is being reduced significantly. We've seen more extreme measures where some plans have been closed down altogether, or the defined benefit minimum being capped at a certain level. So these are the realities of what's going on out there, and it's not the realities strictly in Canada or North America, it's the realities of the world. Everybody, regardless of which country you're in, are facing the exact same issues. When we look at our own pension plan and we say, are the contribution rates that we have sufficient to cover the obligations that we have? Refer to one piece of information that we have available to us, which was a study undertaken by the firm of Towers Watson. And in their best estimate, they came back and came up with this statement that said, for a defined contribution plan to have the same benefits as a defined benefit would require anywhere from 14 to 16% contributions going in. In the slides to come, we'll be trying to compare that to say, well, how does this compare to the realities under the McGill University pension plan? When we look at the measures at McGill, there are really four different measures. A couple of them may not even be relevant for the group here, but they are relevant for others. We'll start off with the first one, which is to say that all members that are above age 39, commencing January 2013, so it's not this year, not 2012, but only January 2013, there's going to be a rate of increase. The recommendation that's been put forward is that for those between age 40 and 49, that the rate of contribution by the member be increased by 2%. For those between age 50 to 65, that the rate of increase be 3%. The university would continue to match contributions according to the existing schedule. So right now, if you're under age 40, under the McGill University pension plan, employees put in 5%, the university puts in 5%. At the point that you reach age 40, the rate of contribution for the member would have remained the same, but the university contribution goes from 5% to 7.5%. Once you reach age 50, the university contribution goes up to 10%. Member contributions of ours remain flat. We know that we need to get 14 to 16% into the pension plan for it to be equivalent to a defined benefit arrangement or your typical defined benefit arrangement. So we know more money has to go in. This is one step towards attaining that goal. When we're looking at the different percentages to try and answer the other question, how do we compare relative to this 14 to 16%, we can see that depending on what age bracket you're in, for the very younger employees that are under age 40, the minimum contribution rate could be as little as 6.4%, as high as 9.34%. So we're still a little bit shy of the mark of 14 to 16%. Once you reach age 40, that percentage could be almost 11% to about 13.5%. So we're getting much closer to what the target amounts should be. Once a person reaches age 50, we can see now we're in the right ballpark. We're exactly that 14.4 to 16.8% range. So we can see that there's still some room, because it's not, employees don't get hired at age 50 and don't have a career only commencing at age 50. So down the road, there may be further adjustments based on what the realities of the marketplace may or may not be. But we know that we're getting much closer to what the ideal target would be. When we look at the rate of contribution under the Quebec Pension Plan, it's very interesting when we look at the McGill University Pension Plan. Since its inception in 1972, the rates have always remained constant. And it was interesting exercise to look at, well, what are the realities under the Quebec pension plan? And we go back to 1972, and you'll see that the solid line represents the contributions to the Quebec pension plan, and they've recognized quite some time ago that you need to be putting more money aside in order for the Quebec pension plan to be solvent. So the government, back in the mid-80s, introduced increasing contribution rates to the Quebec pension plan. And we can see that they are continuing to increase contributions, and it's an ongoing type exercise. Whereas under the McGill plan, up until the year 2013, it was one and the same contribution rates. So just an interesting exercise where we can see that, yes, we are playing catch-up, but it is part of the realities that as time goes on, you need to regularly be revisiting the contribution rates to be able to make adjustments in relationship to what the realities of the marketplace have been over the last or the immediate past. The second change that's being looked at is having to do with, again, the defined benefit minimum. And it's looking at, in situations where there is a deficit, there's additional monies that need to be put into the pension plan for going concern purposes. And there, where today the university has to shoulder these obligations solely, looking at commencing not this year, not next year, not even 2013, but commencing 2014, depending on what the financial position is of the pension plan at that time, that there would be an additional amount that might be required to be put in on the part of the members in order to offset some of these deficits. And this is common practice within defined benefit pension plans that you make additional contributions when deficits do arise. Now, if times are good and the markets sort of perform very strongly from today to into the future, from when the next valuation is performed, and the plan is back into a solvent position, then these measures may never see the light of day. But you can say whenever there is a deficit, if there is a deficit, additional monies need to be put in, that there would be a sharing of those additional contributions. This allows for the sustainability and continuity of the pension plan. It's the way it's the mechanics of, upon which it's going to be made is that as far as the employees are concerned, depending on the value of the deficits, we're looking at the deficits as they exist today. If they would be exactly the same position in the year 2014, it would represent about 1% additional contribution on the part of the membership. So the membership would put 1% into the pension plan, into their own account. The university would withhold the 1% and contribute a full 2% into the pension plan in order to have the pension plan continue. So just a roundabout way of making sure that there is additional funding that allows for the departing employees to continue to receive 100% of the funding and to make sure that there's an adequate level of contributions going in to make sure that the plan will be there for not only today but also for tomorrow. The third change has to do with individuals beyond age 65. And this measure says that at the normal retirement date, and when we look at the normal retirement date, it has nothing to do with when the person actually retires at the university, because you can retire prior to age 65 or after age 65. But the concept of a normal retirement date is the month end in which you turn age 65, saying beyond that date, the required contributions under the pension plan would cease. If individuals continue to work beyond age 65 and they want to make voluntary contributions, they would be able to continue to do so. But the obligation to make required contributions would cease at the normal retirement date. The fourth change has to do with stipends, and this is probably a reality less relevant for this group, but there are a small segment of the population which do receive temporary forms of income referred to as stipends. And here, this change would only apply to those that are participating in the hybrid arrangement. It says that the stipend amounts would continue to be eligible for defined contribution purposes. That means you would continue to make contributions based on those earnings. The university would continue to make contributions there. But for the defined benefit minimum, where we have that formula that says we look at your earnings and we look at your years of credited service, that we would not take those amounts into consideration for that segment of the pension plan alone. So it does mean that stipends do continue to be eligible, but only eligible for the defined contribution segment of the pension plan. Now, these measures are intended to get certain results, and it's to help assist in maintaining the pension plan. When we look at the implications of the changes, the increased contribution rate, what does it mean in terms of our net take-home pay? And what I've done is I've created a little table here to give an example so that you can actually see what the dollar amounts involved might be. Now, not everybody has gross earnings of $50,000. Some of you have a little bit higher than that. Some of you have a little bit lower than that. But it's in the general ballpark. You can see that if you're between age 40 and 49, that would represent a 2% increase in the contribution rate, which would mean $1,000 more. Because we contribute to a pension plan, the value of the contributions we make is on a pre-tax basis. So it actually means that if we're in a 25% tax bracket, and I'm using a very conservative 25%, we tend to be in a little bit of a higher tax bracket than that. But if the numbers work using a 25% marginal tax rate, they'll work even better when you apply the actual rate that's relevant for your situation. We can see that the net reduction in take-home pay reduces to about $750. Divide that by 24 pays, comes out to be about $31. For a person age 50 to 65, that number, you can see all the relevant figures, it comes up to about $46.87 is the net impact on take-home pay. So for these additional infusions of capital, we will be creating a much more sustainable pension plan design. So when we look overall, what are the results? There's no denying that these measures will reduce, ever so slightly, the net take-home pay that we as employees will have. It does also mean that we're going to be putting a lot more aside for our own retirement. And that does mean that we're better chance that we're going to have the type of retirement that we would like. But keep in mind, the pension plan is just one of many different tools available to us. It does create greater stability, as well as sustainability of the pension plan, and it does help secure the future of the pension plan. On that note, I'll be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have. Well, I kindly ask if you can use the microphones when asking questions.
Okay. When the Minerva posts the pension plans for the month of, say, December, that's reflected on which month before?
Okay. What you'll see on the pensions website, it's not actually Minerva. We have a pensions website where we report to everybody what the unit values are for the various investment options. There's a little bit of a sort of jargon that we use. We have a unit value at December 31st. Doesn't reflect the actual market activity at December 31st. The unit value of December 31st really reflects market at November 30th. So unlike if you're receiving a registered retirement savings plan statement, when it reports to your value at December 31st, it's your value at December 31st. What you get under the McGill University Pension Plan when you look at the annual statement, or if you go online for that matter, is the month prior. So as an example, you're looking at your annual statement. It's really November 30th of the prior year to November 30th of the current year. So there's a slight flip or lag in the reporting lines.
When you check every month, if you check on the pension, my account, and you notice for the past 6 months, no matter what you contribute and what McGill contribute, doesn't show. You don't see it, like the market is down. But, I mean, for over the past 6 months, we've taken a big drop. And then if you look at it the past week, the month of November, you know, it increased substantially. Is there a reason for that, or is it?
I'll try and answer the question as best as I can. When we're looking at activity for the calendar year 2011 as an example, the markets have performed a bit erratically, and depending on which period you're looking at, so if you're looking at the most recent unit value, it would suggest that, oh, things are starting to look better because the unit value did go up. But what you're looking at is activity up until the end of the month of October. And October, the markets did actually, in fact, go up. The negative side to the story is that in the month of November, the unit value or the markets have gone down slightly. So if you were to look at to say, where do I truly stand at the end of the month of November, you would have to wait for the December unit value to be published to tell you what the performance has been up until the end of the month of November. So if you looked at the position of your account at the beginning of the year and you look at the position of your account or using the October or November 30th unit value, you would say that, well, things are pretty much, they stayed flat. What you would have seen is an increase in the value of your account because you've put in more money and the university has put in more money into the account. By the end of next month, we'll see what happened in the end of the month of November, so we'll see a slight decrease. Where will it be at the end of the year? I don't know. So until the end of the month of December, we can say that at this point in time, markets are relatively flat if you're participating in the balanced account, that you didn't gain or lose substantially for the year 2011. the month of December may change that statement. I don't know. We don't know until the end of the year to say, you know, where is the dust going to settle for that position. But each month, what you'll be able to see is, for the prior month, what happened as far as the markets are concerned. So just keep that in mind. It's not the current month, but the prior month.
Because when you look at it, it shows you, where we were 6 months ago, where we are now, we're back 6 months back. So everything 6 months up to now is a wipeout.
Any gains, and sometimes it's some of the losses that we're experienced, now you're back to a break even.
Yeah.
But you've put more money in. So that would mean that the value, the overall value of the account has gone up. But it hasn't gone up because the markets have performed, because you've got, you know, rate of return on your investments. The rate of return on the investments now, I'm looking at the balanced account. Some of you may be invested in the fixed income pool, as an example. If you were invested in the fixed income pool, you got a big smile right now because it got a positive rate of return. So it depends on which investment option you chose. The majority have chosen the balanced account, so I'm giving the answer for what would be relevant for the majority of people. But it doesn't mean that everybody necessarily would have the same reflection. For those that were fortunate enough to have, you know, place the good size of or majority of their holdings in the fixed income pool, they'll have a very different perception as to what the year 2011 holds.
Anybody else?
I was just wondering, previous employer have another pension elsewhere. Would I be able to transfer that pension to McGill instead? Like, I would have to remove it, either put it into a lira or transfer it elsewhere. Would I be able to transfer that to McGill?
Okay. There are different options that are available to you. If you do have other pension plans, and even to the extent that you have a registered retirement savings plan with a current financial institution, you do have the option of transferring both of those into the McGill University pension plan. There are certain advantages in doing so. There are certain disadvantages in doing so. I can give you just a very, very quick summary. You may want to consider transferring monies into the pension plan if you don't need those sums. If you're 100% certain that you're not going to need them before you're ready to retire, because once they go into the McGill University pension plan, you have to stop working at McGill to have access to those funds. So you don't put your emergency money into the McGill University pension plan. You don't put your grocery money or your vacation fund. That would be restricting your ability to get access to those sums. But if you have monies that you're certain, absolutely certain, that you're not going to need, then it is an opportunity. Now, why would you do it? Could be one of two reasons or both. One is the fees that are being charged. Under the McGill University Pension Plan, because we're a group, we are able to negotiate with the underlying money managers rates that you could not negotiate on your own. So as an example, overall, under the balanced account, the management fees, which includes everything, my salaries, the money managers, the cost of the systems, the lawyer fees, the actuarial fees, everything all combined, comes out to be a little over 0.5%. 0.6% is the actual cost of the balanced account. If you're buying an equivalent mutual fund on a retail basis, the cost could be as high as 2.5% to 3.5% for a similar type product. So if all the rates of return, if you're looking at two equivalent products, and I couldn't tell you that for each one of us, we have to do the analysis for our own to say, what are you investing in now? If it's comparable to what you're getting under the McGill University Pension Plan, then the question comes to say, why pay more fees when you can pay less fees for something that is similar in nature and performance? The second reason you may want to consider it is that there is a lot of governance that applies under the investments under the McGill University Pension Plan. So there is a pension administration committee who oversees the administration of the pension plan. There's also a pension investment board that they overlook the investments. They're the ones strategizing to say, should you be investing more in Canadian stocks, U.S. stocks, international stocks, which money manager to hire? So there's all this oversight that's being provided under the plan, whereas on your own, you need to be providing that oversight. If you've made certain investments, you need to do a lot of the follow-up and make sure that the investments are appropriate for you over time. Here you've got this extra layer of governance that takes place. So there is a value attributed to that. On the negative side, you have a restricted use, and you're limited to the investment options. Under the McGill University Pension Plan, you have 5 investment choices. When you're investing on your own, the sky's the limit. So for certain people, you know, having a specific investment option may be more important to them than the fees associated with the administration of their accounts. So depending on your needs, it may or may not be appropriate. We always encourage individuals to do the comparison and to speak with an independent financial advisor to make sure that they know that they're doing what's right for them.
Only 30% of the balance fund, or is anything invested in the equity fund, I should say? Because I was always told that 70% of the balance fund is basically in equity. So if you go all equity, you're only basically fooling around at a 30% higher risk of your money than if you're with the balance fund.
Within the balanced account, it is a fund of funds. And the target allocation is that 60% would be in stocks, and 40% would be in bonds, or 60% in the equity pool, and 40% would be in the fixed income pool. Now, it's never exactly 60-40. It does vary over time, but those are the target allocations. So if you feel that 60% in equity and 40% in fixed income is too aggressive or not aggressive enough, then you can supplement that by directing more of your contributions towards the fixed income pool or the equity pool in consequence to what your investor profile would suggest that you do. So each and every one of us has their own investor profile. If you've never done so, I do encourage you to go online. There's virtually every financial institution has an investor profile questionnaire. By completing these questionnaires, it will give you an indication as to your profile. It will come back with a recommendation such as you are an aggressive growth investor, or you are a conservative investor, or a moderate investor. What that allows you to do is to then get an asset mix recommendation that's in line with what your investor profile is. And that's the better way of going about deciding whether you should be solely invested in the balanced account or some combination that's different than the balanced account's weighting of equities versus fixed income investments.
So basically, some of it is in the balance fund, 60 to 70, whatever, is in within the equities.
60% is within equities.
Okay, thank you.
So we can see that, and it's the same balanced account whether you're at the beginning of your career or at the end of your career. So for someone that's just starting off, that may be a little bit conservative. So for someone who's at the very tail end of their career, it may be a little aggressive. So it's for each and every one of us to decide to say, is that asset mix appropriate for us, and to then go ahead and make the adjustments to our own accounts according to our own individual needs.
McGill changed his policy with the annuities. Can you tell the membership what to look for when they take their pension outside McGill and where to go with it, so we all are aware?
Thank you for that question, because I think it's a very good question, and I've got some very positive news to announce to you. One of the things that we have been working on, since we've eliminated the internal annuity option, because it is one of the measures that was introduced to help create a more sustainable pension plan, we have now negotiated with the firm of Sun Life, whereas if anybody that's interested in obtaining an annuity, because one of the two settlement options that you have, once you're ready to retire, you can either buy an annuity or transfer your money to what's referred to as a life income fund. For those of you that are interested in buying an annuity, we've now negotiated an agreement with Sun Life that they would be offering non-commissioned annuities directly to retiring McGill employees. With that means that relative to what you could negotiate on your own, to what this non-commission rate, it could represent as much as 7-8% increase in the final payment that's available to you. So it's an excellent piece of information, and what it does allow you to do, whether you want to buy that annuity with Sun Life or not, it gives you a basis of comparison. If you're dealing with an annuity broker and you're shopping the annuity markets, you now have at least a baseline. You can say, with Sun Life, I've got a certain dollar amount. So you can deal with a broker and say, can you do better? can you find me another insurance company who's willing to offer more than what's available under the Sun Life agreement? So it doesn't necessarily mean Sun Life will be providing the highest rate possible. It does mean that you have now a basis of comparison and one additional offer to take into consideration as you're making that analysis. There's also in existence already, for those that are interested in opening up life income funds, we do have already arrangements, established arrangements with both Sun Life and Standard Life. So if you are nearing retirement and you're interested in opening up a life income fund, you can attend one of the information sessions. We do provide monthly information sessions on the different retirement options, settlement options, and you can get a bit more information about what those offers are all about.